It was still a very low year compared to the longer-term record. It was just considerably higher than last year.
The Arctic sea ice makes a recovery from its record low. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, important native artifacts end up in the Chivac dump.
How can we get those things back? Those were historical and those were the very who I am and where I come from.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
As cold weather dips down into south-central Alaska, word comes that the Arctic Ocean has begun freezing up. The sea ice low was hit on Friday, the 13th of September, according to a press release today from the National Snow and Ice Data Center. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
The ice stopped melting back and began refreezing when it still covered 1.97 million square miles of the Arctic Ocean late last week. Much more ice than last year's record low of 1.32 million. But National Snow and Ice Data Center head Mark Serez says the ice cover is still on a downward trend compared to the average of 2.4 million between 1981 and 2010.
It was still a very low year compared to the longer-term record. It was just considerably higher than last year.
And that is a relief. But this ice is thin. It was protected from the sun by a lot of cloud cover. Scientists are not forecasting any sort of reversal of the long-term decline toward ice-free summers for a number of reasons.
When we say we had a recovery this year, you have to put this in a little bit of context and take it with a grain of salt.
There is a new European Union satellite that can sense the thickness of the ice, and while it hasn't been up long enough to make comparisons between years yet, it is showing the thinness of this summer's ice due in part, Serez says, to storms.
Also, with this stormier pattern, you kind of spread the ice out a little bit more, and that's why we saw big areas of really a lot of open water, low concentration ice, very, very far up in the pack this year, even near the North Pole.
Last year, after the record meltback, the ice was so thin that a January storm spread a pattern of huge leads of open water across the Beaufort Sea in the dead of winter. This time, there's 650,000 square miles more ice than last year going into freeze-up, and much of that will become thicker, multi-year ice.
By definition, the fact that we ended up with some more ice than we did last year means that that ice that survives now can maybe age through the winter. So, you know, could this be something that could increase our prospects for a little more recovery last year? Maybe, but I wouldn't hold my breath about it.
It was 6 years ago when Mark Serez and other scientists were stunned at how far the sea ice melted back, and some predicted it would be the new normal. This year's withdrawal is in the high end of that range, but still within it. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
In the village of Chivac on the Bering Sea coast, dozens of Chupik artifacts like masks, harpoons, and dance regalia ended up in the village dump. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Melvin Pavel reports.
The artifacts had been kept in a traditional sod house that was owned by the Kashunamit School District. The school had built it in their cultural heritage program to show students the traditional ways of living. Superintendent Larry Parker says in recent years it had become a safety concern and a liability issue.
We had at least one student that fallen through it, fell through the roof of it, and the police had to come get him out.
The sod house was erected on the school softball field, and when the school tried to relocate it, they found out it had a lot of mold inside. Parker says the school district talked to the tribal council in the city of Chivac, but neither one wanted the sod house, so the school decided to trash it with all its contents. Chivac resident Earl Atchak says he didn't know that was the fate of what was in the sod house. He helped receive some of the objects from the dump, including stories from elders about being Chupik. He says that knowledge is invaluable.
How to do anything, how to be a Chupik, who are you, who am I, where do I come from and where am I going?
But Parker says the community had notice. He says over a year ago, the school's principal and new cultural director went through the sod house, removed the school's belongings, and notified a man named John Bingayak of the dilapidated state of the house. Bingayak had retired from being the cultural director for decades and had collected the artifacts over the years. Bingayak did not want to interview with KYK because he used to work for the school. Achak says even though Bingayak had gathered the artifacts for the cultural program, they belonged to the whole community. To Achak, it was clear that the artifacts should not have been trashed, no matter the situation. He says they included videos of elders, ivory carvings, books and drawings that are one of a kind and irreplaceable. He wasn't able to salvage all the items, but did retrieve a written interview with an elder who had passed away.
There were pages and pages of handwritten notes. If it was, you know, ruined and burned, how can we get those things back? Those were historical and those were the very who I am and where I come from.
School board member Ignatius Chayelkun says that he's heard only a few complaints from the community about the school's decision. He says the residents had time to do something about it if they wanted to.
She had plenty of opportunity to address this matter. And now, after neglecting all this stuff, totally forgetting about them all this time, they suddenly want to make noise about this whole thing and try to blame the school district for the demise when they themselves should be blamed for this whole thing.
Again, Superintendent Larry Parker.
Sorry if we destroyed somebody's property, but the school cannot be responsible for abandoned property, and we can't keep something unsafe around.
Achak says he's asking the Alaska Commissioner of Education to come to Chivac to address the issue. He would like to see a community-wide meeting that includes the school board and all the residents. In Bethel, I'm Melvin Pavla.
Dozens of people displaced by a fire yesterday in the Mountain View neighborhood of Anchorage will sleep at a shelter tonight. The fire burned a 38-unit apartment building, which is a total loss. KSKA's Daisha Eaton visited the fire site today and has this story.
16-year-old Sarah Messick returned to Glenwood Manor with her parents to see if they could salvage anything from their former home. But fire officials wouldn't let them in. Messick says her family of 10 had lived in the apartment since May, when they moved to Anchorage. With 5 kids in school, Messick says they need clothes and school supplies.
I feel really bummed because I have a lot of school supplies still inside, especially clothing, because it's very cold in the shelter. But we're still hoping for the best, and hopefully everything will turn out good for everybody who lives here in Mountain View.
Fire officials say flames spread quickly through the 38-unit apartment complex. It was built in 1963. The building is still standing, but officials say it's a total loss. Laura Spano is a spokesperson for the Red Cross of Alaska. She says 37 people displaced by the fire stayed at a shelter at the Fairview Recreation Center Thursday night.
Everybody's without a home right now, so we've opened the shelter to make sure that we can get everybody's immediate needs taken care of and work to give them referrals for long-term housing and long-term care. In any disaster like this, almost everything that is in your home has been lost, so we're going to provide assistance for them to be able to replace their clothing and those basic necessities.
Spano says the shelter will remain open through the weekend. The best way to help the victims of the fire, she says, is to make a donation to the Red Cross of Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
It looks like a controversial labor law passed by the Anchorage Assembly earlier this year is headed to the highest court in Alaska. Today, the municipality of Anchorage appealed the decision of a Superior Court judge who ruled a referendum that would strike down the law could go forward. That law takes away municipal workers' rights to strike and restricts collective bargaining rights. The Assembly passed it last March despite a public outcry. City attorneys say the issue is administrative, not legislative, and should not be decided by voters. Opponents of the labor law say the city charter supports the public's right to reverse a decision made by the Assembly through initiative. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska's legendary salvage man looks back on his daredevil career.
We towed an old Navy tanker into Dutch Harbor backwards in the middle of the night one time because we didn't have anything else.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Federal Subsistence Board is seeking ideas to improve the rural determination process. Only Alaska residents living in rural areas or communities are eligible to harvest fish and wildlife resources on federal public lands under federal subsistence regulations. The deadline to submit your ideas is November the 1st. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
University of Alaska Fairbanks Chancellor Brian Rogers warned of budget constraints in his annual fall convocation address yesterday. Chancellor Rogers cited both federal and state funding reductions that are forcing the university to re-examine what it does.
In an era of ever-shrinking resources, can we do it all? I know we can't.
Rogers says it's been clear during the past 5 years he's been chancellor that targeted cuts are the preferred means of addressing funding shortfalls.
One of the things I heard over and over throughout UAF was that in dealing with declining dollars, we need to cut vertically, not horizontally. No more across-the-board cuts that weaken everything, whether already weak or strong. This has meant making some hard decisions, but any cut is going to be hard. We will see services change. Some already have. Sometimes the change will increase efficiency, but some services will, frankly, decrease.
Rogers highlighted Arctic research and job training as areas that the university needs to focus support on, but declined to identify programs that will be targeted for reduction. The University of Alaska Anchorage's incoming athletic director addressed the media today for the first time. He made clear that he views his job as being about more than just athletics. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Arriving in Anchorage for the first time ever on Tuesday evening, Keith Hackett has already spent a lot of time reaching out to community members, ranging from alumni to the media, even taking part in an open house this afternoon where he got a chance to meet the public. Hackett says his community outreach efforts will continue because, as he puts it, a significant portion of his job is to be the face of Seawolf Athletics.
That's going to be a critical role for me because that's one of the things that people told me, that we need to get more involved in community events and community activities.
Hackett comes from an extremely varied background with 37 years of experience in higher education and athletics, including spending time as a coach, a dean of students, a provost, an executive vice president, and for the past 9 years, the senior associate athletic director at the University of Nevada. Even though he isn't officially a coach anymore, Hackett says he hasn't stopped coaching.
I coach my staff now, and I coach young men and young women that aspire to work in our profession. I coach our coaches. And, you know, I think we're all coaches because we do this on a daily basis. What we're doing, you know, we may not be coaching kids that are wearing helmets or wearing cleats or wearing soccer shoes, but we're coaching people to help them to get better at the specific skills they have.
Hackett replaces Steve Cobb, who was fired in May after questions arose about his handling of a 2011 incident where former hockey coach Dave Shayak struck a player with a stick during practice. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
The Anchorage School District's girls' hockey program is back in business. The Scotty Gomez Foundation Hockey Association announced today that it has entered into an agreement with ASD to offer girls' hockey as an outsourced high school varsity sports program. Carlos Gomez, the president of the Scotty Gomez Foundation, explains the agreement.
It's real simple. Girls' hockey's back, and they'll fund it for the first year, and then it's up to us to come up with the money for the following couple years.
Gomez estimates the cost to be at least $100,000 per season. He says after the district announced last spring that it was cutting the program due to low participation, it really woke up the Anchorage hockey community.
When something gets taken away from you, boy, you come back fighting mad as hell, and that's where I think the program's going to go right now. I don't see no problem justifying girls' high school hockey from here on.
It will also be up to the Gomez Association to promote and recruit for the program, but after this year's summer-long battle to revive girls' hockey, Gomez doesn't think it should be much of an issue.
I can foresee girls coming out of the woodwork.
The Gomez Association will work with the Alaska State Hockey Association and USA Hockey to offer the program. Girls hockey will follow the same guidelines as other high school sports, which are outlined by the Alaska School Activities Association. A platoon of artists, dancers, and rock climbers has been working for months to transform the glass front of the Anchorage Museum into a multimedia vertical stage. The creators call it an urban art intervention, and it all comes together Saturday night for a one-time performance. APRN's Liz Ruskin caught up with the performers at one of their last rehearsals.
Because I want to go over to quality of movement.
Choreographer Becky Kendall has a long list of last-minute fine-tuning.
But I think in this section, all of your movement needs to be more jerky and uncomfortable. Yeah, like...
This is a tough show for the dancers and aerialists. It's outside at night. They'll be tethered by ropes and defying gravity. And because they'll be performing on different levels, they won't even be able to see each other.
Like you're about to go over the edge. Probably not like, ooh, but more like, ha!
Kendall is a member of a group called the Light Brigade. They create performance art in and on unusual venues, starting with a 2009 show on the JCPenney parking garage. Kendall is also one of the performers. She says among the challenges this time is the September chill.
The aerialists are all barefoot on the glass. It's a safer landing, and it's also less slippery than trying to wear any kind of footwear on the glass surface. So, yes, we are glad that the show is under an hour. And so we'll go out there, do our best, get done, and warm up at the end.
The Anchorage Park Foundation helped cover the cost of the event. Bruce Farnsworth is one of the show's creators. He says it's been over a year in the making.
The museum, you know, you don't do something in the on the museum on a whim. This building is an important edifice in the community. It's one of the more important architectural landmarks in Anchorage. And if you're going to do something on it, you better do something really cool, because it's already a really cool architectural sculpture. So we decided to take our time.
The piece is called Over Beyond Across Through. Farnsworth predicts it will forever change how viewers see this corner of downtown Anchorage. The free performance begins at 9:30 Saturday night on the Museum Plaza at C Street. In Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Casey Kelly. This week on AK, salvage. For more than 30 years, Dan McGone has run around Alaska bailing out vessels in distress. In the process, he's developed a multi-million dollar marine salvage business and reputation. McGone is a daredevil to some and a savior to others. But now he's the one being saved. Facing rising debt, McGone is selling his shop in Unalaska to a larger company. It's enough to keep the lights on, but as KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, it's going to be a big adjustment for the man at the center of Alaska's salvage industry.
The international port of Dutch Harbor is organized chaos. For all the vessels and cargo that are constantly moving through, it's pretty orderly. Until you make it down the road to McGone Marine. McGone Marine's shipyard takes up 1,200 feet of coastline, mostly covered in scrap metal and the guts of old fishing boats. When owner Dan McGone strides out into the yard, it's a pretty jarring contrast. McGone is neat and trim.
Hi.
Oh, hey!
but he's proud of what he's built. Until now, Magone says his business stood alone.
There's nobody like Magone Marine who's actually, you know, taken and converted barges and boats into salvage vessels and has the capability of getting up to these remote sites with equipment. And so so that's the story. It's just now it's starting to change.
It's changing because Magone sold his business to Resolve Marine Group of Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He went into debt spending millions of dollars to upgrade his fleet. It took a long time and a lot of money to get the ships to comply with new safety codes. Magone realized he couldn't do it alone. So now, Magone Marine is called Resolve Magone Marine Group, and Magone's rusty shipyard is suddenly crowded with shiny new vessels sent up from the south.
This vessel is the Resolve Pioneer. She's 207-foot long anchor-handling tug supply vessel.
That's Todd Duke. Duke's a director for Resolve, and he's been sent up along with some spill response equipment, a heavy barge, and this ice-class tugboat. Duke says he's in town to help get the new partnership set up.
A lot of my job is just to look and collect information.
And a lot of that information is about Alaska. Resolve doesn't have a ton of experience in the region, and they're still trying to figure out what equipment they'll need. But some of the intelligence is about Magone himself.
He tells some stories that quite personally scare me. You know, like living on the beach in an ice storm, you know, that's not for me.
Duke's talking about a salvage job Magone Marine did in Accutan a few years back. Magone remembers it well.
This is the Icy Mist wreck.
It was a fishing vessel that ended up on the rocks.
And when it wrecked, you couldn't get on the beach because it was too rough down there, and there's no place to, so you couldn't get a boat in there, and you couldn't land a helicopter.
So every day, Magone's men rappelled down a cliff to the job site. He shows me a picture of himself in a harness and hard hat.
Time to go to work.
But as Magone tells it, that's nothing compared to some of his other jobs. He salvaged vessels that no one thought could be saved. He lashed together two longliners in a pinch to double as an emergency response vessel.
You know, we towed an old Navy tanker into Dutch Harbor backwards in the middle of the night one time because we didn't have anything else. But now that Resolve's involved with this, you know, then they've got, you know, adequate equipment to handle the bigger tows, and we'll handle the smaller stuff.
Magone's going to use his own ships, but he's going to have a lot of other resources at his disposal, courtesy of Resolve. Joe Farrell runs Resolve Marine Group. He says he's wanted to expand into Alaska for a while, but he had to find the right partner. When his friend Magone wanted to sell, it seemed like a perfect match.
Dan and I really seem to have married each other in our backgrounds in terms of, you know, taking something from nothing and making it into something.
Magone started out as a commercial diver. Farrell was just a tugboat operator in the early days. But as the business grew into Resolve Marine Group, Farrell says he stopped having to do all the work himself. Magone Marine, for the most part, just stayed Magone.
The difference between Dan and I is I've had the ability to have a lot more talent available to me in terms of down here, we'll say in the lower 48.
There's a lot of turnover in Unalaska. People come and go. Magone is one of the few constants, and he doesn't delegate. That's why at 61 years old, he's still going out on rescue jobs. Life still consists of
a lot of wild nights climbing up onto ships and saying, okay, you know, show me the problem. Where does it hurt?
And that's why Joe Farrell is sending Magone some relief. Along with fancy tugboats and barges, Magone is getting a new staff of emergency responders. They'll rotate in and out of town, but they'll all be trained to Resolve standards. Magone will still be the boss. The jobs that come across his desk will still be big and risky. That's just Western Alaska. But now, Magone won't have to be the one to take the risks. He's not about to go soft, though. As he closes up the office for the day, Magone tells me he's headed off to the city pool to do his swimming routine.
So I do a half a dozen crawl strokes, and then I do a half a dozen laps, or maybe a lap and a half underwater with fins.
It helps prepare him for diving jobs, but it's also good exercise, and that's something Magone's picky about. He's not a natural runner, and he says he feels silly on a bike. The water, though, he doesn't mind one bit. And on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to Manicotic, a community of about 450 people west of Dillingham on the Igooshic River.
My name is Lillian Gamechuk Game, the tribal clerk here at the Manicotic Village Council. It's very beautiful. There's a mountain and a river, and whoever comes here falls in love with Manicouagan. Most of them are commercial fishermen. Some are teacher's aide or teachers. They had to close down the fishing for a Igooshet. In the tender when it went underwater. It was during the peak season too. We have only one store and no restaurants, but there's some individuals that make homemade pizzas for sale, depending on if they have the ingredients. For fun, they go hunting, subsistence hunting. The moose, when it's open season, terrible open season, then there's spawned out redfish, graylings, ptarmigans during the winter, pikes during the winter. I was raised here, and my family is here, and it's my home sweet home.
Lillian Gamechuk is the tribal administrator in Manicouagan. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Lauren Rosenthal, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Melvin Pavilla in Bethel, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Liz Ruskin and Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Casey Kelly was our AK guest host this week. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by ERA, for more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.